Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
And Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Interdependence is a series of conversations with people shaping 21st century culture. If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron. In this episode, we catch up with Trevor McFedries, the founder of the meta media studio Bread, whose digital avatar artist and influencer, Lil Miquela, recently caused a stir through signing with one of the world's premier talent agencies, CAA. If you don't know what meta media is, don't worry, we'll go over it. We discuss the origins of the project, why he sees Miquela as more of a challenge to Mickey Mouse than human artists, and also some pretty bold ideas for how avatar-led projects might help us reorganize the music industry to be more equitable. First of all, it's really wonderful for you to join us. We're so excited to talk to you. If you could just introduce yourself a little bit and your background and also about the formation of Bread and et cetera.
Sure, yeah. So my name is Trevor McFedries. Grew up in Davenport, Iowa. Moved to LA in the middle of high school, stumbled into software engineering professionally and then kind of haphazardly ended up in this rap group that put out a top 10 album. And as a result, got thrust into this music industry in like 2007, 2008, where people were looking around for answers. And because I could write some code and knew about some things, kind of created this professional life where I've lived at the intersection of media and technology for most of my adult life. And, toured as a DJ and as an artist for a long time. And while I was doing that, produced for Pop Acts. And then, pardon me, in 2010, 2011, got a call from the Spotify folks and came on board there to help launch Spotify in North America. And while I was there, really kind of had my mind blown by lean startup and this ability to make things and ship them quickly and talk to your fans or customers and iterate versus spending 5 years making, an album that no one wants and pushing it off a cliff. And, in parallel, I've been managing and producing an artist named Banks and watching the traditional hacker spaces that I had lived in forever, whether it was on IRC or other channels, kind of move from this techno-optimist progressive space to this more regressive kind of corrosive space. And, while I was kind of digging through that stuff, got into Will and Grace and the Jeffersons and all this data around how some of those television programs had, shaped our American reality more than most policy. And, that was kind of the impetus for thinking about this company, Bread, and kind of building a modern Marvel or Disney and trying to create narratives and talent or celebrity that could do what software does well, which is touch billions, but do what I think, narrative and talent does well, which is kind of create these deep visceral hooks that can shift people and the way they think about the world.
That's really interesting. I want to push you on something there because I think it's actually really, really interesting. You're working in a capacity within music where, you've had the experience of a top 10 record. I know that you have very close ties, like you toured with Katy Perry for a very long time, right? And you produced for a bunch of people who were kind of, this is, I'd imagine for many people, really a wild destination, right? I mean, like, to go from the position of having very little access to being in those kind of halls is quite a journey. And it's very, very interesting to me to learn or to maybe push you to explain a little bit more why you started seeing more opportunities in this space of starting companies and experimenting with technology when clearly there were many opportunities available to you in the music industry, right? The only reason I say this is I think that this is a general trend that I've noticed amongst a lot of dynamic people is they're kind of looking at music and being like, I can make a bigger difference elsewhere. And it's just interesting.
This is the famous Bowie quote, right? He was like, yeah, if I was a young person today, I'd go into some sort of internet business or something.
Yeah. But I think that's really interesting to talk about for a second, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure I've ever addressed it directly or kind of thought about it directly, but a lot of my friends are contemporary artists and live in the traditional art world. And I've always thought, and I've been asked to kind of do gallery things or do art things. And I've always pushed back because I think growing up in the Midwest and being raised on Casey Kasem and Top 40 and kind of like Abercrombie and Fitch, and then moving to LA in the middle of high school and like trying sushi for the first time and throwing up because I was so repulsed. It always kind of made me want to be this kind of like teacher or conduit. Like I think I was talking to Arya Dean and I was jokingly like, I'd always just wanted to be this like 2 Michelin star corn dog. Like this connection between like the people that I adore and that I love so much in the Midwest who have been kind of closed out from things because of like big academic language or concepts that could be, you know, explained pretty, you know, simply, but are kind of like veiled in all of this nonsense. And so in technology, there was probably less pretense. And I think bizarrely, a bit less of this conservative streak. In music, there's this kind of romance and maybe ideologies that prevented people from taking big risks, where in technology, maybe it kind of overcorrects a little bit farther on the other end, where they're like, come in, fail miserably, and here's a big check to boot. And, you know, yeah, that was definitely intriguing.
I wonder if that speaks to the kind of startup community in Los Angeles versus San Francisco, because I feel like what you're describing is not necessarily what I associate with tech communities. I often see it as kind of something, I don't know if elitist is the right word, but often like with a kind of institutional backing, you know, like a pedigree kind of research center or these kind of things. So it's interesting that you saw technology as something that was more easy to access than pop music. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I guess you're probably right. I guess for me, what I saw was a lot of parallels to the music industry. I mean, like pitching a VC isn't entirely different than walking into a record label and, you know, trying to present how cool and interesting you are and, I don't know, jumping on a table and performing for Lear Cohen, whatever it is. But I think what was refreshing is that people there were really interested in taking big risks. I mean, for a lot of reasons, the music industry was neutered when I existed in it. And so there was, you know, entire industries operating out of fear. You know, if you sign an artist who was being produced by, you know, the Ucker Luke or Max Martin, and they failed miserably, like you had a parachute. Versus taking a risk on like some pop act produced by me in like my basement in Silver Lake, you know, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, but I think that's so true. It's almost like the record industry in some ways is, I mean, that would be a criticism I have with the exception of like really special corners, you know, like
yes,
it's kind of in austerity mode where you have, you know, incumbent large institutions that are really, really keen to play it safe. I mean, like I was talking to someone earlier about this where, you know, it seems to me like the A&R strategy for the real big companies that have, you know, the real kind of budgets to be able to enliven the imagination of millions of people, it seems like they're just looking for opportunities to be able to pour gasoline on something that's already got some momentum, you know? It's like absolutely, the whole idea that the record industry is this visionary place is somewhat, you know, is somewhat easy to challenge when you look parallel and you see, you know, small little skunkworks operations or small little organizations such as Bread, for example, just kind of being like, no, we kind of want it to look like this, you know.
Maybe you've nailed it there. I think because of where I existed in the music industry, you know, I was always a bit too pop for like an XL or Beggars or something. You know, they would send me like Azealia Banks when she had run through every other producer that, you know, but I also was like a bit too weird for straight ahead pop labels as well. And there wasn't really an explicit place for me in music at that time. And I think when I walked into Silicon Valley, there was so much capital and there's so many different types of people that, you know, you could build, you know, big libertarian decentralized computers or, you know, like DTC sock companies and, you know, you wouldn't be starving. And so maybe at some point there was just like, yeah, this works for me. It's the place where I can exist.
Interesting. I wonder how WeWork and the whole SoftBank fiasco is going to change that environment. Yeah, just like throwing bags immensely of money in.
I feel like all the like Y Combinator undergrads are like starting DJ careers to like,
you know,
to fund their startups.
I do get a lot of like, you know, Silicon Valley people whose dream it is to be a big EDM DJ, and you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, this is a way longer conversation, but I think that the two ideologies are so inextricably linked.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it's like, I mean, Fred Turner wrote a lot about this, but like, you know, there's clearly some correlation between the independent musical kind of you know, one person starting a band in their basement, in their garage, and one, you know, Steve Jobs or whatever starting a company in his garage. Like these ideas are very much kind of coupled in at least the American imaginary, you know. So it makes
in the
a
California
lot of,
fantasy. For
yeah,
sure.
It's totally. It's like yeah, like a.
But before absolutely. We get yeah. before we take off into California fantasy, maybe we could talk a little bit about Brud. Can you explain what Brud is and how it started and what you guys are up to right now?
Yeah, so Brud is a transmedia studio based here in Los Angeles. That's kind of a big funky word for we tell stories with virtual characters, virtual celebrities across multiple channels at the same time. I often kind of describe what we do as being like decentralized Mulan or something. You know, mm-hmm. our biggest character is a character named Little Michaela or Michaela, who has, you know, is going throughout her life as this, you know, sentient robot, this fictional sentient robot, navigating, you know, her dreams and ambitions of becoming a global pop star. And in parallel, kind of dealing with the trials and tribulations of being like the penultimate other, you know, this robot navigating life in an otherwise human world. And, mm-hmm. From jump, the dream has been to like tell cool stories and to make cool things with our friends. There's other kind of more ideological ambitions, but at the kind of core, it's like, let's tell great stories in a way that feels really modern and topical. I don't think if you were going to start Disney now, you would start in theaters, or if mm-hmm. you were going to start Marvel, you probably wouldn't start in comic books. You would probably try to create characters and stories where people's eyes are now, which is largely on their phones and in social.
So just to clarify, Lil Michaela is, there's no AI going on there, and she's not really a robot. But part of the narrative is that she is a robot living in the world. Did I get that right?
That is absolutely correct. Yeah. So okay. What we do is kind of, I guess like some people have called it parafiction. The best comp I always give is like WWE. I think like mm-hmm. a really good mechanism for getting people to pay attention in a world that otherwise wouldn't is to, you know, to create fictional stories in places traditionally reserved for nonfiction. So like mm-hmm. when you watch someone get hit with a chair and you're kind of forced to take pause because you're like, that was fake, but I think he got hit. That's kind of the same thing we try to do over and over again. So it gets quite confusing when I say that, like, yes, Michaela is this artificially intelligent, sentient robot navigating Los Angeles, but that's entirely fictional and scripted.
I think what confuses people is that she's entirely human generated. And when people hear AI, they think that she's kind of has her own, I don't know, free will or whatever, but she's actually the entire thing is crafted by the team at Brud. And so I think that's where people totally. Get so confused maybe with this narrative.
Yeah. And it's funny because like Michaela has, for people listening at home, Michaela has millions of fans and, you know, magazine covers and billboards in Times Square and, you know, all the kind of trappings of an emergent young celebrity. But her core audience is young, you know, they're 12 to 18 and some of their first friends were like Roblox or Minecraft, you know, players, and they've had virtual mm-hmm. relationships before. And so they don't get hung up on that stuff the way I feel like my 30 plus friends are like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of that's like one of the challenges for us internally is that so much of our world is people just like adoring and loving this stuff. And then like mm-hmm. a Brooklyn blogger being like, wait a minute, this is, and you're like, huh? Okay, I need to reframe.
Yeah, it's funny because for me, I mean, what you're talking, it's great for you to mention the WWE, which of course I'm of the age where I think of the WWF. And like what you're describing is kayfabe, right? It's like,
exactly.
It's and what, I mean, what's kind of brilliant about that in a sense, I guess from your perspective, is that of course any controversy catalyzed by these kind of fictional kayfabe kind of scenarios only contributes to the narrative around Michaela, right? So, you know,
absolutely.
The journalist coming out and making these grand claims about, you know, how problematic the project is only continues to further this narrative, right? It's
absolutely,
you know, and we can talk about like some of the complications around that, but that seems to be part of the point is, you know, in your kind of casting Michaela as a robot making her way in the world, naturally everything she encounters in this journey is part of that storyline, right?
Well, another absolutely. Thing I thought, oh, go ahead.
You're totally right. I mean, I think what's fun too is there's a whole generation of kids that are kind of in on that like anti-fragile kayfabe, where they're in on this joke. And when they watch like their parents' generation bug out about it, they get to snicker and laugh and be a part of this thing. And it kind of has this self-reinforcing component as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the age thing, because I saw some, I was, you know, reading, I think there was a article in Refinery about Bermuda, who I think is another character that you got. And one of the, they were interviewing some younger people, and someone was talking about Michaela, and she said, yeah, you know, Michaela's not even a human, and she's out there doing whatever she wants. I find it so inspiring that I can be whatever I want to be. And I thought that was such an interesting, she found it so like inspiring and aspirational.
It's pretty beautiful. I think, you know, one of my favorite parts about the younger generation is their ability to, like, I don't know, interpret reality and identity in, like, you know, these quote unquote fluid ways. And we often get messages from gender nonconforming or like non-binary teens who are like, you know, I live in Missouri and no one believes that my identity is what it is, or that I exist, or that I am real. And to see, you know, someone who exists in this other plane succeed is really inspiring. And that kind of stuff is, you know, really, really impactful and powerful, and not something that I ever would have imagined going into it.
Yeah, it's a couple of things. So on the Brud site, I don't know if you guys still have this up, but I recall that I first came across Michaela, I guess, in 2016 or so. This project's been going for quite a while, right?
Sure, yeah, that's about right.
And one of the first things that I read on the site, which obviously got me very excited for, because of my, you know, pre-existing conditions,
because of your dogma.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was the question on this topic of kayfabe, right? Like, there was the question, is Michaela real? And of course, your quite trolly, but awesome, yes, kind of response is yes, as real as Rihanna. And I know that, I mean, I've been following, we'll talk about the CIA thing and the blowback about that, but that was the first thing that kind of that got me very interested in the project before I had actually encountered you. Like, and I do wonder, because I mean, you do have experience in the pop music world, like, do you first, like, do you think people care where their music comes from? And do you, looking to segue or transition this into a greater kind of conversation about the agency of pop people, period, right? Like, the distinction, the difference between what you see as the average punter consumer and what actually happens beside the scenes. Like, what prompted you to make that statement with regards to Rihanna?
Well, I think there's something kind of surface level where, you know, for us, this idea that I'll never touch or interact with Rihanna in meet space, but she's ever present in my life, is something that, like, I wanted to explore in that statement and also just be kind of trolly. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, you know, we're all so close to the machinations of, like, popular media and popular music especially, that, you know, I just know that Bieber didn't write that song. And I know that your favorite pop star, that probably isn't even her full vocal on that record. Like, it's probably still Bonnie McKee or Sarah Ahrens or whatever it is. And beyond that, like, you know, you watch the kind of manufactured authenticity take place. And I guess you can get, you know, disenchanted, but at the same time, recognize that there's something really special and powerful and enabling the creativity of all these stylists and songwriters and producers. And maybe if there were, you know, different incentive structures or different architecture to all of these things, it could be, you know, a system that was more equitable. And so I think all of that informed that thought, but on the surface, it was just me being cheeky probably.
No, but it's good.
And of course, people are really protective over their pop idols. I mean, even though I feel like in 2020, everybody is aware that things are constructed on social media and, you know, that their pop stars are fully constructed. But at the same time, you know, when I was doing a little bit of research for this talk, I just saw people on Twitter were just so upset about especially the Rihanna.
Well, what's really funny is this idea that you, through creating a fictional reality, are in some ways bursting the bubble of another fictional reality,
right?
Yeah,
that they want to protect, right? So ultimately,
but I'm baffled that that's still not obvious to people.
Well, no, but I think it is. But I think I think you actually mentioned this earlier when we were talking about it. I think that people realize that the pop world that they encounter is fictionalized, but there's something painful.
Yeah, they don't want to be confronted with that.
There's something painful to confronting that I think you're definitely kind of
agitating.
Yeah, and it's so funny because so much of our my time and our time, I think collectively, is spent like dealing with, you know, all of this adoration from the fans. And you know, when I encounter like that Twitter thread or whatever, it's always interesting to me because it feels like, it almost reminds me of like the Jeremy Corbyn, like Bernie moment, where like there are these echo chambers. Obviously they're so pronounced, they can feel like those kind of themes are omnipresent, but they're like so small in our world. That said, mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely correct. For a certain generation of people, it's probably really frustrating. And I'm sure they feel the same way about K-pop. You know, I'm sure they feel the same way about, you know, lots of different things that have kind of removed some of the romance of like the single-minded great genius in the lab, you know, cooking it all up. But
which is funny because the pop star would have replaced the kind of band from the previous generation. So it's like each generation gets more and more kind of.
Well, that's the thing. We're definitely on the kind of generational cusp where the idea of approaching a pop star as kind of an authentic representation of something is absurd, right? Like,
yeah,
that's definitely like on my, at least from my like born in the 80s scenario, like I grew up just not at all taking pop stars were manufactured. That was part of the idea, right? And at some point that appears to have transferred over.
For your entire life, I'm sure, up until the age of about 14, you probably.
I was really into Alice Cooper.
Yeah. and the Spice Girls. You were really into the Spice Girls.
Yeah, I was actually a member. I was a member of the Spice Girls fan club. And I was once kissed on the cheek by Emma Bunton.
Baby Spice.
I will say, I'm in a similar boat. I was born in 85 and I wore a Hanson Sucks t-shirt to class I got kicked out. Because I was like, I was so into like biscuit and corn and like, you know, like cold chamber or whatever.
Oh, wow. Damn.
Wow.
Me loco.
Yeah, that's good stuff, baby. Good culture.
No, but it's
I think you're right. There's a generation of kids that grew up on like indie pop. And I think, you know, what I was presented with when I was 8 or 9 with like Backstreet Boys or NSYNC was probably different than getting like Lorde or Ellie Goulding. Or these artists that, you know, have had probably a more like an independent trajectory, even I guess those are both major label acts.
Well, it's also true. I think it also speaks a little bit to the way in which the industry has morphed in that time where like the previous, like when I was growing up, in a sense, you had mega stars where ultimately actually, and it's funny, Fisher talks about this related to the Beatles. It's one of the most beautiful things. It was actually the last speech I think he gave. Mm. Was he rolled up and spoke about how the Beatles ultimately weren't supposed to be pretending to be you or I, but because that they were working, very talented working class people, with every record you expected them to confound expectations even further. And in doing so, you kind of went on that journey with them and you expected your pop stars to be, you know, just pushing boundaries, experimenting with drugs, going to far off lands, doing things that you would never do. And as a result, like they were kind of taking you with them, you know?
Yeah.
But in my lifetime, at least, I'm born in 1984. So I guess I'm a year older, but like as you've seen this transition, and a lot of it goes along with digital tools, of all of a sudden expecting these megastars to, one, be kind of like you, and number two, speak directly to you. Right. Mm-hmm. Which I think does kind of blur those boundaries, because before you'd have manufactured pop and then you'd have like bedroom indie, which is like the girl next door, the boy next door. It's, you know, like people who are kind of a bit more like you, a bit more touchable, a bit close.
Yeah.
And now the expectation, of course, is that everybody is like that, because the new tools that dictate our attention are basically tools designed to at least present some kind of a simulation of intimacy between people. Right. And so, yeah, so it feels like that might be why these things get super confusing, is that previously the pop stars that we used to want to be like going to the moon, now what we really want is for them to like, you know, whisper into our ears as we go to bed at night or something. Like,
I definitely agree. And I remember when Gaga kind of nailed splitting that difference. Like, I remember working with Katy early on, and, you know, when fans would see her, Katy Perry, fans would tremble and like shake and kind of have that reaction they would have had to like a Michael Jackson. And then you'd see, you know, kids see a Logan Paul or Cameron Dallas in the street and just run up and hug them. And you know, that relationship was really polarizing to me. But like, Gaga was really able to thread that needle quite well, where she had all of the kind of pastiche and regalia of like coastal elite high fashion, but then like this little monster kids in El Paso, like running up and hugging her thing that I thought was really dialed and so perfect for the moment.
Yeah.
It's been really interesting to see how COVID's kind of shifted that dynamic a little bit, because you see all these people in like really palatial LA homes being like, we're all in this together. You're like, oh, wait, this isn't working.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But speaking of the kind of journey, I don't know if you can reveal any of the secret sauce, but I mean, Michaela went from basically like an Instagram account to being, what was it, 2018's, you know, one of the most influential people on the internet.
Yeah, like Time Magazine.
Exactly. Time Magazine. Yeah. Exactly, which is wild. So like in such a short time span, how was she able to grow so quickly?
You know, it's a good question. I think obviously, you know, there's some novelty to it at the beginning, which helped accelerate a bunch of things. I think, you know, we've got a team of people that are really talented. And, you know, I'm sure you guys have this frustration as well, but like one of my frustrations oftentimes is looking at like well-capitalized businesses is like, man, like if I was going to do this, I would hire all my smartest, most creative friends and do this so much better. And like, you know, trust me, that's harder than it seems. But what we've been able to do is hire a lot of like my favorite creatives and thinkers and just say like, let's come in and try to create narratives that are simultaneously as engaging or as compelling as a Trump's or a Kardashian's, but, you know, have these themes imbued inside of them that, you know, again, like on the surface might seem dense, but if you don't talk down to young people, are probably more than acceptable. And, you know, early on, like my favorite things is when you'd have like some 12-year-old kid in the comments be like, she's not real. And then have an 11-year-old be like, she's realer than Kylie Jenner. And you watch a bunch of like preteens have their first Baudrillard moment, like in the Michaela comments. Like that's the kind of shit that we live for. And I think, you know, in a post PG-13 ratings world, most mainstream media talks down young people. And these kids are so smart. They've had every question they've ever had answered since they were a seed. And so we just try to like talk to them like they're adults and present themes and ideas that are important. And it's resonated thus far.
One thing I will say though, I'm going to try and play devil's advocate at times.
Please.
So on the one hand you have, and I agree with you in a sense that I think that there's a lot of kind of like moral panic around these issues, particularly amongst people above a certain age. And I know from, you know, speaking to, for example, I have my students at NYU are from like 18 to 22. And I'm like just blown away by how switched on they are and also how nuanced their understanding of the web is in the, like, you know, we are concerned for our parents are like basically deceived by the web. We're constantly on edge as to whether or not we're being deceived. And these like younger people are basically like so on top of it. Like they can smell, you know, they have like five different expressions for the you know, the gradient of skepticism that they have on any particular thing, you know, and of course that makes sense because they've grown up in this very weaponized environment. That being said, of course, like another angle to Michaela is she is beyond being a kind of a performer or a star in a role. You know, she's also takes on the role of an influencer, right? Like I have no doubt that one angle of your business model is receiving money from brands, from brands to kind of place them inside these narratives. Like what kind of calculus do you do on the moral responsibilities of that? Because like on the one hand you have these really smart kids who I do actually believe have generated a lot of kind of armor, and they have a really good bullshit detector basically, and then on the other hand you have, you know, the reality of the advertising industry, which is based on, you know, I mean,
deception.
For want of a better term, deception. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, not wanting to be too freedom fire on it, but yeah.
You can call it fantasy if you want.
Yeah,
deception. Real Adbusters hours. I mean, let's go.
Yeah, so exactly. So, what kind of moral calculus do you guys do on that? If you don't mind talking about it,
you know, I think I've always treated what we do, you know, much like I would probably treat creating like Sex and the City or Entourage, like these stories that exist in our reality. I mean, for me, it's very much X-Men. It's like watching X-Men address the Cold War was very informative for like my politics and helped shape who I am. But the way you watch an Entourage or a Sex and the City kind of explore our, you know, reality and then introduce brands or products in ways that felt, you know, relevant, kind of set a tone. But for us, like, we don't do a ton of brand work. We tag a bunch of brands that, like, we just fuck with that we think are interesting. A lot of the stuff that we do is, like, Michaela and Prada, where, like, you know, Mrs. Prada reaches out and this former Italian socialist who's, like, into all of this rad progressive technology stuff is like, we want to get you involved in what we do. We're like, that makes a ton of sense. Let's do it. The flip side of that is, like, we absolutely want to build a gigantic business. I don't think an advertising or kind of influencer business is venture scaled. And so it's definitely not a priority, but it's just a conversation. Like, I'm sure it would be with, like, you know, Ariana Grande or Bieber or Rihanna, like, hey, this brand reached out, they want to do a thing. Do we think it makes sense for, you know, your brand, Michaela? Do we think it makes sense for, you know, directionally where we want Michaela to head? And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And if it does, then, like, we'll take that check and, you know, use it to feed some of our creative, talented friends and employees.
Says, yep.
Does that work? Does that answer your question?
That works.
Okay. I was listening to New Models. Some friends of ours were talking about Michaela last week's episode, and Carly was talking about how, you know, there's this outcry online about replacement and the idea of real human influencers being replaced. And I thought that that was really almost funny to think about, that maybe, like, a younger generation thinks of influencers as workers, which is something that's maybe absurd for an older generation to think about. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting point she was making.
I definitely agree. I think I'm old enough where I hear the term influencer and it definitely feels a bit repulsive, but the kind of core idea there, like, being able to influence is so much of what we're interested in. And so, I don't know. I definitely, we talk about our characters far more. Like, I imagine, like, you know, a Disney type of studio or like an Illumination would, but they're certainly influencing. They certainly exist in that space. And when I do see comments about people that are upset that, like, she's taking jobs from, like, the individual model or the individual influencer, it always feels a bit silly because obviously there's, like, you know, 30 of us in a room, you know, a creative team full of, like, you know, Black, brown, you know, gay, straight, you know, female, male, like, all and non-binary folks, like, just creating stuff that we want to see in the world. And hopefully leveraging those brand dollars, those venture dollars or whatever it is to, like, put some bread in creative people's pockets and make things that people are inspired by or mobilized.
It's interesting for us because obviously Holly and I have been doing a lot of work on machine learning, and there's this idea of automation coming in to replace people, which of course is a spectrum that's existed with good reason for, you know, for well over 100 years. It's kind of like the original kind of scary story around the robot. And of course, the funny thing about any of the musical work that we did with machine learning was that was by far the most human labor intensive automated process I can ever imagine. Like, the actual successful work that was at least represented in the press as involving a kind of AI component was, like, the most laborious thing. And I think it's kind of funny similarly here that, in a sense, like, this concern that Michaela might be replacing someone, I can imagine that it takes an incredible amount of resources and time and consistency to grow, you know, what is ostensibly a digital character to this level of success and maintain that. For sure. You know, the idea that this is an automated thing that just anybody can do seems a little absurd to me. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is kind of like the AGI, kind of like Elon Musk. They're all coming, the paperclip AI is going to destroy this thing. I mean, I always think, like, anyone who's, like, programmed a calculator and then, like, had it not work is like, oh, software is nowhere close from fucking destroying our lives. Like, we've got plenty of time. And there are real concerns for sure. I think, you know, fairness and, like, you know, poison data sets are things that I got far more worried about than, you know, I don't know, robots coming to steal my influencer jobs. But you're totally correct. Like, you know, we've built some pretty cool pipelines and impressive technology to do what we do better, faster, cheaper, mostly because, you know, traditional BFX animation is kind of trapped in, like, 1990s architecture. But it's intensely human intensive, and that's a lot of the fun, is getting to pull some of my favorite peers into a room and try to address challenges and address problems that haven't been thought about in novel ways for 20 years. But you're totally right. There are a lot of hands in the pot trying to figure this thing out.
I'm really curious about that actual workflow. I don't know how much you can talk about here, but I mean, just like, yeah, how are decisions made, I guess, with so many different people involved? You know, I guess in a traditional kind of pop star hierarchy, the star would be able to make the kind of final decisions on in certain areas, and in other areas not. That would be up to maybe a label or someone else. So yeah. How are kind of big decisions made about like which partnerships to pursue, or even like which outfit to put on?
How horizontal is your consensus mechanism?
Well, actually, when we're thinking about governance, we created tokens. No, that's a great question. You know, in the beginning, I think in the beginning, we were thinking a lot about this book, Creativity Inc., which is based on the history of Pixar and how they would create these brain trusts, which would basically allow all the folks who had a kind of, who were stakeholders on a project, on a film, on Toy Story, whatever it is, to get in, see a cut of the film, and suggest notes that, that weren't prescriptive, that would just say like, hey, that second act could be stronger. And we do a lot of that where we have our creative team, but we have like technical people, you know, anyone in the org can say like, I don't think that looks good, or this could be better, or what if we did X, Y, or Z? And then the people who kind of own that project make decisions. And the other part was the dream for me always was to try to create, you know, an infrastructure that would allow for, you know, these characters to be platforms more or less to enable, you know, some of my peers who may have had a nice blog house moment but didn't time things correctly, or, you know, maybe didn't want a tour, or, you know, maybe hated the idea of doing press, to use these characters as vehicles for their creativity, where they kind of have like a heat shield, or where we could eventually create these like decentralized popular cultural figures that could, you know, pay dividends back to the people that were participating in creating them. And so that's largely how it goes down. We've got a bunch of people in a room. We talk about what makes sense. Obviously, there are kind of like character Bibles and stuff like that. But it's a lot of people talking it through.
That's really awesome. I want to talk way more on that because I think that's really, really compelling. Like the first, I mean, we've actually had this conversation before, I believe, but like specifically this idea of kind of having a character represent a larger kind of group of people making decisions for that character and potentially enjoying the spoils of that character's successes. A few things come to mind, right? Like, have you read Toby Shorin, Sam Hart, and Lottie's Headless Brands?
I've not read it, but Toby and I have talked about it briefly.
Oh, interesting. It's funny. It pretty much falls along like some of these themes, where it's more specifically talking about things like the Ethereum protocol or whatever, right, where you have a large group of people invested in this transnational decentralized project where ultimately the code base is in the hands of the group, and if you mm-hmm. choose to fork it in a certain direction, you can kind of take it in that direction, right? But maybe more interestingly, I mean, like, we've thought a lot, for example, about the idea of, you know, like a DJ, say, going out and, you know, making a bunch of money performing other people's work, and DJs being these interesting kind of revenue generating figures that could in fact be sustaining entire communities behind the scenes. Absolutely. And I just really like this idea because I think that like it really is like the strongest counter narrative to what I think is ultimately a rather kitsch human replacement narrative. The strongest counter narrative is thinking of ways to make these kind of representative bodies, whether they be organizations or digital avatars in this case, as these kind of like revenue generating moments or revenue generating institutions that can then distribute money back to an invisible group of people. Like, that to me is really, really fascinating. And I want you to talk about it for a long time.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's some of the most exciting stuff to me as well. And I think that's, you know, if ever I'm frustrated with this project, it's when, you know, people who are talking about need, the desire or the need to create new economic models for creative people, when they push back against this, I'm like, but like, this is a thing. This is like real kind of like categorical disruption if we enable this kind of thing to like see itself through. And so like one of the things I get really excited about is even on like a traditional song, right? Like a record deal structure would allow for a certain.
If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, you can find it on patreon.com/interdependence. Thanks for listening.